This is the truth.
What?
He didn't hate it, but he didn't care about it. It's like,
well, I'm rolling already, so I'm going to leave that in. Good day, Thomas Jefferson. Our podcast listeners.
It must be the rush of the holiday season. I'm having a nervous breakdown in the barn.
We talk about Christmas this weekend. Wow. The first segment, we devolve
into
our...
There's a rant, and that was mine.
Yeah.
I seldom rant. Well, maybe sometimes.
Well, the point is that Jefferson was a deist, and he was not going to celebrate Christmas.
And he traveled. He frequently traveled on Christmas. He frequently worked on Christmas. It literally was not a holiday for Thomas Jefferson. But that's all right. He's entitled to that. He wanted freedom, and the rest of us can enjoy it.
And silly me trying to make sense of that and give you a nice out. Nope. We're going to take it, were you?
Not taking it. No, sir. Not doing it.
I have a hunch you're going to have a few people who are going to hear like 10 minutes of this conversation and be writing you.
They can, because I'll tell them, here are the letters.
Jefferson wasn't that way. He could never have been that way. He's a founding father.
Yeah,
he believed in Christmas.
But at the end of the show, when you finally got some rationality, you admitted that Christmas was banned in New England for over 100 years.
Yeah, I remember that show. And doing some research, trying to keep up with Jefferson and coming across that and just
by
being,
Jove.
Holy moly.
Yeah, banned because it was thought to be an idolatrous Catholic traditional ceremony, and Protestantism had tried to sweep all that away.
And there was punishment if you tried to celebrate Christmas.
What do you make of the whole war on Christmas trope that the far right loves to get into?
It's just entertainment.
I mean, come on. War on Christmas? There's a lot of Christmas in this country.
Yeah.
That's a lot of Christmas.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any war.
But as I said in the show, if one of those people heard you in this week's show, they'd be coming for you.
You know what I did?
They'd be coming for you.
So here's what I did. You'll love this, because one of the things that bothers me, apparently lots do, is I don't like cutting down Christmas trees, because it seems like such a... There are 300 million Americans. That's a lot of Christmas trees.
You know, I have a nephew out in Decorah, Iowa, who worked last year selling Christmas trees. And you know where he worked? He worked at a tree farm where they specifically
grow trees
to a specific
size.
And then you can go out and cut your own tree.
I can't bring my head around it. So here's what I did. My nursery guy actually stopped by my house for other reasons. And I said, you know what I'd like is three ponderosa pines alive in big 5-gallon bushel baskets, and I'll put them on my front porch and put lights on them, and they'll be live Christmas trees. And then in May, I'll transplant them to the backyard in my house where I have a few gaps, and then I will solve two problems with one little action.
See, now what a nice... What a nice Christmas
story. Now, that's the Christmas.
Why didn't you bring that up during the show?
How would I have? You didn't give me an opening.
You grump? Jeez.
But isn't that lovely? So I have live Christmas trees.
It is. It's great.
They'll be transplanted, and they'll live for the next 60 years or more. And no tree had to be cut down for this purpose.
And if you did that every year, you'd have a little forest out
there. I did. So I've done it once before, and I got four one year, and they're all still alive in my backyard.
I've seen them, but I didn't know their origin.
And now three more, and then this spring, next year I'm going to do two, and then I'll be finished.
We're losing everybody.
But I went out and bought bulbs, and I was out in this kind of quasi-blizzard, stringing them up, and just like Griswold and Christmas Vacation, I've got plugs, I'm plugging them, I'm trying to find connectors. I'm out there being Mr. Christmas. And so how dare you accuse me of being a curmudgeon?
What did I, do that?
Yeah, well, sort of.
I said grump.
Yeah, well, both. But anyway, that's the truth. And so, and this, as people know, if they listen to this program, I'm going to be alone this Christmas. I begged for gifts from all of our listeners. I don't know if that means anything to them. I'm going to have a great time. And the last time I was alone on Christmas is 25 years ago.
Now, you're talking Christmas Eve.
I'm talking Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Going to be in tears, and you know it.
I might go to
I may come up and peek in your window.
Oh, I hope not. I might go to a midnight mass, a midnight observance of some sort. I love that. And my mother was in a congregational church, and they would light candles and form a circle around the perimeter of the interior of the church and sing Silent Night. And I'll tell you this, maybe this will redeem me in your mind. My grandparents were German Americans. They lived in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. They were dairy farmers. And we would go on Christmas Eve to the services in the church there. And they would sing a few carols. And then they would sing Silent Night, my favorite by far of all Christmas carols. Another wild prejudice, I don't like secular Christmas music. I like holy Christmas music. They would, the time would come for Silent Night. My grandfather would sing it in German.
Nice.
And it was so beautiful.
I'll bet.
My mother
what
said—
What a great memory.
It's just so beautiful to think that he had that ethnic pride.
See, now why didn't you bring that up in the show?
Because we were talking about a deist by the name of Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, it's the art of conversation. Change the subject.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, look, my favorite Christmas of all the Christmases of my life was when I was in eighth grade and my parents bought me a 35-millimeter camera back when there weren't any. And I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I still have that camera. I still have
the, what is it? What is it, like a
Pentax?
It was
a Canon SureShot.
Wow.
And it was my first 30. I felt so grown up. My father had to show me how you load film into a 35-millimeter camera. I have the first 12 pictures I took that day.
Oh.
That's also the year.
You still have these photos?
Yes.
You should share a couple.
And I got Abbey Road for Christmas.
Wow. What a year.
And it was like the greatest thing in the world, Abbey Road. If I only had one Desert Island album, that would be it. I loved it. It was a big part of my adolescence. I soon then became a photojournalist, and I had a Canon F1, which was like the greatest camera that this country had at the time. And I took 10,000, maybe 50,000 35-millimeter photographs, developed them in a darkroom in our house. I mean, this was big. This was Christmas. That's the best Christmas gift I ever received.
That's interesting. I did the same thing.
What?
Cameras developing.
When was this?
In high school.
So you had a darkroom?
My first journalism learning was, and I had this great journalism teacher, Mrs. Munson, and
Bismarck High?
Yeah, I was a sophomore, and we got darkroom privileges. And
so they had a darkroom, you used it?
Yeah.
Tell me you never turned to a young woman and said, let's go in the darkroom and see what develops.
I did, but
we all did.
I married her.
Yeah,
I did
good.
Marry her, so. And I'm still married to her. Merry Christmas, everyone. And next week, we're going to talk about New Year's. Jefferson was a lot happier about New Year's. And also, we're going to talk about some of the upcoming shows and a bunch of suggestions people have posted on social media for. So
yeah, we're planning next year's sequence of 52 new programs on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Let's listen to the show.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with a man who does not believe in Christmas, President Thomas Jefferson, and also with the man who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, the gentleman seated across from me now, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good day to you, sir.
Well, Mr. Jefferson did not believe in Christmas because there is no evidence that Jesus was born on the 25th of December, and Jefferson was a deist and a skeptic and a kind of a anti-Trinitarian Protestant.
Sort of a grumpy guy about the holiday.
Well, I happen to believe that Jefferson was right. So we say we separate church and state in this country. That's part of our inheritance from the First Amendment and
from me on that.
And then yet you have Christmas holiday, which means where are Muslims in this? Where are Jews in this? Where are Hindus in this? Where are Lakota or Crow or Shoshone Native Americans in this? Where are atheists and deists? Why are we privileging Christmas, which I love, by the way, don't get me wrong, as a federal holiday, when in fact it is a Catholic, Christian tradition.
Well, I can answer that if you would like me to.
Please.
And it's directly from Mr. Jefferson.
How's that?
The majority rules.
No. There's where you are wrong, my friend. The majority does not rule on questions of fundamental rights. That's why we have a Bill of Rights. The majority in this country wanted to shut down opposition newspapers with the sedition law in 1798. Jefferson said, no, the Constitution says that's not something a majority can do. The majority wants to create a creche or put the Ten Commandments on a courthouse lawn or put Santa Claus and Christ back in Christmas. They're free to do it privately. But the Constitution says, no, that's not something you can impose upon the citizens of the United States because we have taken that off the table. You agree with these laws.
Of course I do.
The majority rule cannot be allowed to govern on the fundamental questions of this country.
I was just trying to rile you.
And you have, because you made it seem as if, well, if, and this is what they say. You know this. This is what they say in a town, say, in Alabama or Colorado. They say, look around. We're all Christians. Why can't we have a nativity scene on the courthouse lawn?
There is a certain news network who would just put you up, for lack of a better term, crucify you
Fine.
For what you have just said.
I'd be happy to appear on that news network and explain to them our history.
If there were no religious connections to the holiday, would Jefferson say, all right, you can do that?
Sure, have at it. If you want to call it Saturnalia and give gifts to each other and drink eggnog, I wouldn't be a federal holiday, but go for it.
So he objects mostly on the grounds that it cannot be a federal holiday.
That, well, not just that, but we do have a separation of church and state. So today when we look at Christmas—
But we also have freedom of religion.
And you're free to have Christmas. Look at this. What if there's a town in Montana of 1,000 people, 920 of whom are Muslims, and they want to have Muslim religious observances in the public schools? Who's going to cry loudest against that abuse of our Constitution? The Christians. In other words, they only want to violate the principle of separation of church and state because they happen to be in the majority, and they think that that entitles them to lord it over those who are not Christians or those who are skeptical of those traditions. But the law, the Constitution, is on the side of the skeptics, not on the side of the observers. And all you have to do in any cases like this is just reverse the lens and say, what if the town were mostly Muslims? Would you say, have at it, do whatever you want, be Muslims? You can do whatever you want. The Christians will just have to cringe. Of course not. That's not how it works. And so I object so strenuously when people do this, and this is the number one argument. I lived in western Kansas in this tiny little town. I loved it there. But they said, when you show me a Muslim, I'll be more careful. That's not how it works. We are a Christian nation in demographics and tradition, but we are not a Christian constitution. And the Constitution, which I invite everyone who's listening to read— I sound like Ebenezer Jenkinson here. I invite everyone who's listening to read the Constitution and show any reference of any sort to God, Godhead, Providence, or Christianity. None. Zero. Zip.
May I have a minute?
Maybe.
To apologize?
Because you've said something that lends itself to those who would ruin this country for sectarian ends.
If I could finish.
Yes, sir.
To apologize for eliciting this emotion, and to point out that it is my job as the, what is it, semi-temporary, permanent?
Well, very temporary at the moment.
Guest host. to get your opinions out of you, and so I apologize for riling you up. And then, if I may finish.
Yeah, of course, sir.
I agree with you 100%.
But do you acknowledge that by letting the word slip while the majority rules—
I just wanted to see how you'd react.
Dangerous ground in a free society.
Last week we looked at Madison's, Jefferson's letters, and one of the things that stuck out was Jefferson saying, the majority rules always.
No, he didn't. But he did believe that the majority has almost sacred powers in a free society, which I also agree with. 51% is law, except on illegal searches and seizures, except on cruel and unusual punishments, except on imposition of a religious test oath for higher office. There are certain things that the Founding Fathers set aside in a document called the Bill of Rights and said these are too important to allow them to be adjusted by majority rule. These are beyond majority rule. Majority rule can't— It's like the Second Amendment. Our friends who love the Second Amendment as their favorite constitutional amendment say, look, if you don't like the Second Amendment, the answer is a counter-constitutional amendment, not routine legislation. And I happen to agree with that.
I'm trying to bring you down a little
yeah.
bit. You
yeah,
know,
well, Merry Christmas to you, too. Yeah.
But the letter says, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read it to you.
From Jefferson.
This is Jefferson to Madison. December 20th, 1787, he writes,
1787.
After all, it is my principle that the will of the majority, capitalized majority, should always prevail. If they approve the proposed convention in all its parts, I shall concur in it cheerfully, in hopes that they will amend it wherever they shall find its work wrong.
Right. And that is true, of course, in everything except those areas that are
fenced off by the Bill of Rights. So let's say the majority amended it and said Christmas is the national holiday of the land, and that's that.
It wouldn't stand the test of a court challenge.
It wouldn't.
No, because the Supreme Court or appeals courts would say it's a clear violation of the doctrine of separation of church and state.
Well,
let's say the majority tomorrow said that Fox News could never broadcast again, or a majority tomorrow said that MSNBC could never broadcast again. The courts would step in and say, no, that's not how it works. The First Amendment guarantees their right to speak their minds in the public arena. That's why we have a Bill of Rights. You know, one of my favorite sayings about this is that the Bill of Rights is not important in routine matters. The Bill of Rights becomes important in controversy. When you say, I will defend your right to say that.
We got to get out of this because I'm feeling like it's high school
it's
and I got
quite Christmassy, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'm feeling like it's high school and I'm on the debate squad and they say, okay, you have to take this position. And even though you know it's wrong, I just wanted to ask you a little bit
and
about
I'm giving you my answer.
Have you read any good books lately?
I didn't
enjoy any wine.
I read A Christmas Carol.
Oh,
God
you?
Bless us, everyone. I love Christmas. Don't get me wrong.
Uh-huh. But it's not a national holiday.
It is not or shouldn't be.
Okay. So we have before us a bunch of listener questions.
We should cut 98% of that out.
No, it was great fun.
Well, except for the poor audience looking for a cheerful Christmas show.
I have handed you a bunch of listener questions.
I have them in my hand.
Prepared for us by Graham.
By our webmaster.
Who went back and sort of sorted through mail. Mm. Starting out was Thomas Jefferson a Christian?
Well, and the answer is probably not, but not necessarily not. So let me try to qualify that. Jefferson was a Unitarian and an anti-Trinitarian, and he was not certain that Jesus was the Christ. But he never fully disentangled himself from the Episcopalian Anglican Christianity of his childhood. And there's never a fully doctrinaire Jefferson. He's certainly not an atheist. He's a deist. And he's not an absolutist about these questions. But he does believe there's no Trinity. That's foolishness. And he has very serious doubts about whether Jesus was the Christ, and says on a number of occasions, Jesus himself did not think of himself as the Christ. So that would be, for most people, that would be, no, he's not a Christian.
Most people become engaged in whatever religion they...
Of your upbringing.
Yes. At a very young age when they have no concept, they have no choice in the matter. I would assume that the same was the case for Thomas Jefferson.
Now, we don't really know very much what his parents believed, Jane Jefferson and Peter Jefferson. We have to assume that they were not evangelical because Jefferson never talks about them and never seems to have reacted against that. But let's say that Jefferson, I think it's fair to say, grew up in a moderately Anglican household that accepted the Book of Common Prayer and the Anglican Episcopalian view of things. But then he went to college. And when he went to university, to the College of William and Mary, he began to read the great texts of the Enlightenment, and they caused him to ask some serious questions about Christianity. And these are questions that, in some sense, percolated through his life for the next 50 or 70 years. Jefferson was very much interested in this question because he believed that it's a serious one, that one's faith, one's commitment to a religious structure is not something to be lighthearted about it, as in, say, a high school debate course. And Jefferson took it very seriously. And he never really came to some sort of final, settled solution. But he was, I think it's fair to say, a Unitarian and a deist. And that came to him not from family, but from encounters with books and with professors at the College of William and Mary.
The question of Jefferson and Christianity, what more can you tell us about that, Clay?
You know, David, this is one of the most extraordinary areas in Jefferson's thinking. A number of books have been written about Jefferson and Christianity. There's a lively scholarly debate about it, and then there are people who want to argue against the evidence that Jefferson was a very traditional Christian.
We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, we'll answer a number of these questions. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to The Thomas Jefferson Hour, our weekly conversation. It is a conversation, isn't it?
Hey, you started it.
I'm not going to start it again.
You started it.
Yeah, I did, and I apologize.
Majority rule.
And as stated at our last break, we're going to answer some of the questions we've received from listeners. And you've looked through these, Clay. There's some good ones.
There are indeed. I think people care about this. And, you know, we look to our presidents for more than just tax policy and tariffs and foreign affairs and so on. They're the representative of the nation. And so we look to them for guidance on important questions, and we expect them to conform to the basic norms of American life.
Did Jefferson do that?
Yes. For example, one of the questions is, did Jefferson attend church? The answer is yes. He was not a regular churchgoer. If he were at Monticello, I doubt that on a Sunday morning he got on his horse and rode down the mountain to church service in Charlottesville. Sometimes he would have done that, but mostly not. But when he was the president of the United States, he frequently attended church services, ecumenical services in the House of Representatives chamber, because he felt it's a good thing to do, that it's a good time to be quiet, it's a good time to be with other people. The people look to the president, hoping that he is conforms to the essential norms of the culture, and so he did it. When he was sitting there, did he pray to God? Not very likely. Did he believe the sermon really was accurate when it talked about walking on water and raising Lazarus from the dead and so on? Probably not. But Jefferson was not the kind of village atheist who rubs your nose in his atheism. Jefferson was a quiet, careful, dignified, social harmony lover, and so his attending church is a sign that he was not some sort of a loudmouth atheist who wanted to sneer at the tradition.
Well, wasn't that sort of dangerous? I mean, it's dangerous in this time. If we had a person running for president that said, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, that would pretty much doom them.
The number one charge put against Jefferson in the elections of 1796, 1800, and 1804 was that he was an infidel and an atheist. So it mattered. That's why Jefferson never divulged his religious views to other people. He never made public pronouncements about them. And when he edited the Bible, as he did during his first term as president, he did not publish it or share it with others. Jefferson was very, very cautious. And today, you're right. It's strange, David, but today, if Jefferson were alive today and were running for president, he probably couldn't make it based upon his deism and his Unitarianism. In his own time, there was actually somewhat more respect for privacy, and Jefferson was able to have his private views, and they didn't intrude upon public perception much of his character. But in our time, if he said what I have said today on this program, that Christmas is irrational, that we must have a very high wall of separation between church and state, and that it's unlikely that Jesus was the Son of God, I don't think his candidacy would get very far.
I'm going to begin with a question from Billy Rose Paxton Einselin. I hope I have that correct, Billy Rose. Essentially, she asks, did he become an Episcopalian? She talks about how Episcopalians didn't really even exist in the new nation until 1787, 1788. She writes that Thomas Jefferson was born into an English family who lived in the English colony of Virginia, where he was likely baptized and maybe confirmed.
Both, yes, both.
Into the Church of England, the established church of the colony. So that's correct.
Yes, he was born Anglican, and he lived his life as an occasional observer of the Anglican tradition. His children were baptized in the Anglican tradition.
So did he become an Episcopalian?
That's a hard question. In other words, the Anglican Church morphed into the Episcopalian Church. Did Jefferson formally become an Episcopalian? Probably not. But he gave money to the building of Episcopalian churches, but also to Baptist churches and Presbyterian churches. So I would say that the fundamental answer, or the essential answer to that question is no. He was a nominal Anglican, but he didn't ever formally subscribe to the Episcopalian system.
Andrew Mills writes, I recently went to Colonial Williamsburg, and one of the stops we made was the Bruton Parish Church. Inside on the pews, they list all the famous historical people who used or rented a pew there. It came as a surprise to see a pew listed for Thomas Jefferson, as he is famous for being a deist. Can you elaborate on when Jefferson might have gone to church there and why his name would be listed there?
It was for Jefferson, social... That doesn't put it in quite the right tone. It was a harmless thing to do to go to church. He didn't go because he believed. He didn't go because he believed it was a temple to the Jesus crucified and risen. He went because he was a member of the Virginia establishment, and that's what the Virginia establishment did. He was what we would call a nominal Christian. He was not an evangelical Christian. He was not a born-again Christian. He wasn't a practicing Christian. But he went to church from time to time. And he was the governor of Virginia for some of this time in Williamsburg. And so he would have attended church services, maybe not every week, but often. And as a member of the upper echelon of Virginia society, he would have had a pew that was marked off for him or dedicated to him.
Paul South writes directly to Mr. Jefferson. He says, I've read in some present-day texts that you often attended weekly services of various faith traditions, except the Calvinists in Charlottesville. Beyond church and state separation, what is the proper role of faith in America? Should religion play a role in our continuing formation as a people? And again, he's directing Mr. Jefferson directly. Can you do that?
Go into character?
Well, either answer however you wish.
I'll be Jefferson. Yes, every person in America should worship the God of his choice without civil reward and without civil penalty. If you believe that religion is one of the energies that bind us together, that creates harmony, or that discourages error or crime or sinfulness, then of course, we're a free society, which means you can worship any God you please, and that the state will never attempt to coordinate your spiritual or religious life. John Adams and others believe that religion was central to a society, that you couldn't hold together a society unless people yielded to some restraining order that was beyond themselves, and that this couldn't just be the judicial system. I don't happen to agree with that. I think that we don't need formal religion in order to be good people and good citizens or to have a society that's harmonious. But I don't object to those who see it otherwise, as long as they don't try to force their religious opinions down the throats of other people.
Another one for Mr. Jefferson, if you please, Mr. President, from Jacob Clark. He writes, Dear Mr. Jefferson, much has been said on both ends of the political spectrum of your cutting up the Bible. How true is the conception that you were a secular deist intent on turning Christianity into a rationalized ethical system and cultural tradition? Is America a Christian nation, and can it survive without traditional Christian values?
Let me answer the second question first, sir. Is America a Christian nation? Yes, historically and traditionally. Legally, no. In Constitution, not. But in terms of its demographics and its history, yes. Can we survive without being a traditional Christian nation? Of course. Certainly we can. Maybe we're better off if we're a religious people. I know many of my friends in my own era would have said that. I don't happen to believe that. But if the question is a naked one, can we survive without traditional Christian values? The answer, I believe, is yes. I think, for example, the golden rule, do unto others as you would wish them to do unto you, is a universal principle that has nothing particular to do with Christianity or Judaism or any other creed. It's universal. And so I believe we can be a harmonious and righteous nation without any formal creed of any sort. As to the larger question, cutting up the Bible, I certainly didn't intend to convert anybody to anything. I never in my life attempted to proselytize a person in any direction whatsoever. People are entitled to believe whatever they please. But I did, at the urging of others, take a razor to 2 copies of the New Testament and produced a scrapbook, which is now known as the Thomas Jefferson Bible.
On to another letter from Jeff Chun. He writes, "Dear President Jefferson, because you were fluent in many languages, such as Greek and Latin, I'd like to know if you knew Hebrew, and if you were familiar with the Jewish Talmud, and if you were familiar with the tractates that dealt with civil laws and property rights."
I did not know Hebrew. I never made an attempt to know Hebrew. If I'd had more time and could have been a pure scholar, I certainly would have wanted to read Hebrew, because I would have wanted to read the Old Testament in its original tongue. But I did not have that skill. I knew Greek and Latin about as well as they can be known, but I have no Aramaic and I have no Hebrew, unfortunately, and I feel a certain amount of chagrin to have to admit that. I was familiar generally with descriptions of the Talmud, and I knew something about the civil laws and property rights in the great Jewish tradition, but I would never present myself as an expert in these things or a scholar.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
You're welcome, sir.
And now, if you would like to take the wig off, we'll go back to you, sir. I don't think we've ever done this.
I'm just like dizzy now. Yeah. Who am I? Am I going to be Meriwether Lewis here soon?
Take a deep breath.
I'm Theodore Roosevelt. No, I'm J. Robert Oppenheimer. Yeah. I'm John Steinbeck.
So we have one from Jeremy Lassley. "Dear Clay, Thomas Jefferson, during his years as president of the United States, created his own edition of the Gospels of the New Testament." Well, it's sort of the same question, but would you like to address that as yourself rather than President Jefferson?
Let me just go on. Similarly, the great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy edited his own version of the Gospels called The Gospel in Brief. "It seems to me," says the letter writer Jeremy, "that each man was attempting to get to the heart of the Christian teaching, that is, the actual words and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth in both. Almost all mention of miracles and the supernatural is omitted. Do you think that both of these historically significant men were attempting to find the same thing?" Yes, I think that both of them understood that that formal Christianity, the church, the hierarchy, the priesthood, the doctrine, the search for heretics, the whole apparatus, the whole, let's call it, empire, or the institutional apparatus of Christianity, had veered dramatically from Jesus, and that the Reformation, for example, which comes well before Jefferson's time, was an attempt to return Christianity to the primitive church, the church of Jesus and the apostles. And the Catholic Church held out for things that Jefferson would have regarded as baseless traditions. And the radical Protestants wanted to clear absolutely everything out that couldn't be proved by an actual demonstrable text in the New Testament. Jefferson isn't really part of either of those. He and Tolstoy and others were attempting to resurrect the historical Jesus. They believed that there was a human being named Jesus, that he lived about the time he is said to have lived, that he was a rabbi and to a certain degree a rabble-rouser, that he had a magnificent ethics: love God with all your heart, love thy neighbor as yourself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and that this simple ethics, which is understandable by the merest child, was the greatest ethical breakthrough in human history, and that if we would only adhere to the simple truths as articulated by the authentic human being Jesus, not the Christ as he was invented by Paul and others, that harmony and goodness would have a better chance on earth. And so this is part of a movement in the Enlightenment to jettison from Christianity those things that were impossible to secure in the Bible, or that were now regarded as embarrassments. And for example, walking on water was regarded by Jefferson as a simple embarrassment, a fable unworthy of human reason and skepticism, or raising someone from the dead. Really, says Jefferson, can't happen, didn't happen, it's a myth, it discredits Christianity. So he and Tolstoy and others wanted to go into Christianity as we received it from the Old and New Testaments, and then and expunge those things which discredited the life and moral outlook of the historical figure Jesus.
To finish Jeremy's question, he says, can the influence of Jesus of Nazareth be seen in the lives of these men?
I can't answer to that.
Of course, if you look at Jefferson and what he did to edit his own Bible, he cut a book up and pasted the sections that he believed into his own version of it. Wouldn't that lead you to think that he was influenced by him?
Yes, of course. We all have our heroes. And for Jefferson, Jesus of Nazareth was a hero. And he admired him greatly and said that maybe he was the greatest man who ever lived, or maybe it was Socrates who was the greatest man who ever lived, or maybe it was Isaac Newton, but in that cluster of sorts of people. And Jefferson tried to conform his life to Christian or Jesus principles, maybe Jesusite principles. Of course, he failed in ways, as we all do. Jefferson could be a politically nasty fellow at times. Jefferson had a slave mistress. We find that very, very troubling now. It's more Old Testament than New. So, he's an imperfect exemplar of what he took to be the historical Jesus. But I think he felt, in every situation, try to do the right thing. And, you know, if you think about that, David, I know from my own life, every time I have sinned or erred or gone astray, I have known, no part of me blundered into sin. I walked in feet first. We know what's right. We know what's wrong. We know you don't steal from your siblings. We know you don't cheat on your taxes. We know, and so on. We know. When we do things that could be called sin or error or crime, we almost invariably know what they are, and we can try to convince ourselves that that's not true, but it is true. And so Jefferson was really looking at the baseline ethics of Jesus as the right set of principles by which to try to conform your life. And I think he was a sincere believer.
We have a couple of questions regarding Buddhism from Joe Gochi and Ian Adams, wanting to know if there was any evidence of Jefferson or the Founding Fathers being involved or influenced by Buddhism.
None that I know of. That's the shortest answer I ever gave on this show. Confucianism probably more for Jefferson than Buddhism. Jefferson was fascinated by Chinese Enlightenment culture, and he would have known the Analects of Confucius and would have been, he would have admired them.
Books in his library support that?
Yes, but Buddhism, I think not.
Mm-hmm.
David, it's really interesting. Jefferson had a copy of the Quran, and he studied it. He studied it for the wrong reasons. He studied it to determine whether the North African pirate states were correctly citing the Quran for their jihadism.
So there's evidence that Jefferson studied other religions.
He was interested in comparative religion, to be sure. And if he had had more life and a more leisured life, he would have known Hebrew. If he had lived long enough to know what Thoreau knew, that the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads are sources of extraordinary wisdom, he would have probably tried to learn Sanskrit. But Jefferson is solidly, deeply in the Western tradition, which is the Judeo-Christian tradition, and what he knows beyond the limits of the Judeo-Christian tradition is very limited.
We have more questions right now, sir. We need to take a short break. We'll get back to these questions when we return. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Hello, everyone. It's Clay Jenkinson, just sneaking in a little announcement between segments of the Jefferson Hour. I want you to join me this winter at Locksaw Lodge, west of Missoula, for two humanities cultural retreats. The first one, Water in the West, January 13th through 18th, and the second, Shakespeare Without Tears, January 19th through 24th. For more information, go to our website, jeffersonhour.com/tours. We'll see you in the mountains. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. I'm Clay Jenkinson, today mostly out of character, although the semi-permanent guest host of this program, David Swenson, has urged me to suit up a couple of times. We're answering listener questions and taking advantage of listener mail, but we also began by discussing Jefferson and Christmas, and it led to a relatively rancorous outburst on my part. Because I believe so strongly that Jefferson was right about separation of church and state.
You know, it's the holidays, it's Christmas, there's people all over the country and overseas listening to you, and I'm trying to sort of be the mediator between those people, saying, how can he say that? Jefferson never would have believed that.
But he did. Jefferson and Madison, the friendship between Jefferson and Madison was formed over separation of church and state. They both felt really, really, really strongly about this, and Jefferson gave us the phrase in his famous letter to the Danbury Baptists, a wall of separation between church and state. And I have a friend who's a scholar of this, who's the head of the Manuscripts Division of the Library of Congress, and Dr. James Hudson, and he has discovered in the actual manuscript that Jefferson said a wall of eternal separation between church and state, and then he crossed out eternal. But he felt strongly about this one.
To me, it's kind of that position protects religion.
Yes, it means you can be a Seventh-day Adventist in this country and not be persecuted. Or if you are, you can turn to the law for protection. It means that you can be a Catholic in Nebraska in the 1870s when Catholics were openly persecuted and the KKK actually was attacking Catholics and Catholicism. And the American legal tradition protects you because you are entitled in this country to worship the God of your choice. And you can do that in any way you want so long as it doesn't break out into antisocial public behavior. In other words, if your religion requires you to behead goats, and they're your neighbor's goats, you're probably going to prison. But if your religion says that you should talk about goat beheadings, that's no skin off Jefferson's back.
And I keep going back to some of the earliest settlers in the Americas who came here for religious freedom because they had none in Europe.
Why were they coming? They came mostly out of England. England had the Anglican settlement, which was somewhere between radical Protestantism on the left and traditional Catholicism on the right. And so in the age of Queen Elizabeth and James I, there's something called the Anglican settlement. And for many Puritans and evangelicals, it was way too conservative and too willing to retain some elements of the Catholic tradition. And so they couldn't stand that. Meanwhile, they were so obnoxious about it that the state church, the Church of England, persecuted them, and they were frequently arrested and beaten and tortured and killed, horrible things. But this was an age of religious intolerance. And so those Puritans and the Pilgrims first left England and went to the Low Countries, as you know, or some of them just came directly to New England, and they found that here in America, I can be a radical Puritan, and no one's going to stop me. Fine, that's how it works. Different colonies had different religious settlements, and there was an interesting variety. Maryland was Catholic. Rhode Island was Presbyterian and Congregational. Virginia was Anglican, and so on. This worked out well, but then the question is, all right, now what? We're a union. We're a nation. So in Jefferson's Virginia, when he grew up, for example, the Anglican church was the established legal church of Virginia. People were expected to pay tithes to it. They were expected to go through religious ordinances, marriage and baptism and so on. There were fines for non-attendance at church. And if you happened to be a Presbyterian living out on the frontier, you had no rights, and you were frequently persecuted or jailed for it. And Jefferson looked at this and thought, wait a minute, freedom's freedom. Everyone should be entitled to worship the way he or she chooses. We can't have a state church. And virtually the first thing that he did as a young statesman was to disestablished the Church of England in Virginia. He says three things on his tombstone in the end, that he is the author of the Declaration of Independence, he is the creator of the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, and he's the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. The Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, passed in 1786, said you can worship any god you choose, anyone in this free country.
This leads into a question in our list here from Cheryl Masters, who says on a past show you were saying that many states had, quote, state religions. How is that possible when it was totally unconstitutional?
It wasn't yet. It wasn't yet. And so Virginia had a state church, the Episcopalian Church, and northern colonies had state churches, the Presbyterian Church or the Baptist Church. Some of these lingered on well into Jefferson's adulthood, but Jefferson thought, no, this is not in keeping with the idea of human freedom, so we're going to make sure that there is a level playing field, and the Baptists and the Methodists and the Moravians and the Lutherans and the Catholics and the Orthodox Greeks and the Jews and the Muslims, and everyone gets to worship as they please here in Virginia. And he got away with it. It was one of his first great acts, and it was the one that made his friendship with James Madison so rich so early.
I remember several years ago speaking with President Jefferson around this time of year, and we talked about the Puritans. Well, you just brought the Puritans up.
They banished Christmas.
Yeah.
There's humbug, because they made Jefferson look sweet-tempered about this. The radical Christians, the Puritans, the Presbyterians of New England, outlawed Christmas observances because they regarded it as idolatry.
You could be fined, you could be jailed, right?
Yes, and that you couldn't do it because they said, no, that is Catholic superstition that has no biblical basis, and therefore we're not permitting it. It's idolatry. Well, today, you have conservatives who are saying, well, let's bring Christmas back into Christmas. Let's celebrate Christmas again.
We have a local car dealership that does that in their ads.
You know, I see those ads, and they bothered me to no end because they start by saying, here at blah-bitty-blah, we always keep Christ in Christmas, and now let us tell you about some car deals. And the rest of the ad is about what a great time of year it is to get yourself a, yeah. That really bothers me, the hypocrisy of it.
Jason Eisenhut. If we have separation of church and state, why do elected officials swear in a Bible when taking the oath of office?
They shouldn't. They shouldn't. And I was really glad when the first Muslim in Congress in Minnesota took his oath on the Quran. And whose Quran was it?
Jefferson's.
Jefferson's Quran, which was pulled out of the collections, out of the stacks at the Library of Congress for that purpose.
Zena Thorpe writes in, and she wants to know about Jefferson's relationship with the French philosopher and politician C.F. Volney, and asks about how the relationship with him influenced Jefferson's separation of church and state clause.
No, I think that the Volney was a French philosopher, a member of the French Enlightenment. Jefferson had dealings with him. Jefferson read his works. I think Jefferson actually helped to get one of Volney's works translated into the English language. But Jefferson's principles on this were established before his encounter with Volney.
Thank you, sir, for answering all of those questions. And in the time we have left before we go to your weekly essay, let's make up, shall we? And let me wish you a very happy Christmas, however you choose to celebrate.
And let me say to all of our listeners, Merry Christmas to you. I'm not afraid to use those words. Christmas is a huge part of my upbringing. My mother loved Christmas. When I cleared out her storage facilities this fall, I found enough Christmas dishes to feed all the people who wanted loaves and fishes back in at the Sea of Galilee. My mother loved Christmas. She had Christmas ornaments in every possible direction. We had a Christmas ball contest in my house that my sister rigged year after year after year. Fruitcakes are still a part of my life. I make them every year.
Yes,
a family Christmas toffee recipe.
And share them readily.
I bring them here. I'm sorry to hear that attitude.
Oh, no.
Thought we were making up.
We are.
Yeah. I love Christmas. I loved it more as a child. I think that's almost universally the case. I loved it as a parent of a child.
Oh, and can we give Jefferson a little bit of a break? You know, there are stories of him as a grandfather with the children on his knee. And maybe he didn't celebrate Christmas in the sense that Americans think of it now, but they did have feasts and they did have family together.
If you took today, not to be grumpy, but if you took today's Christmas observance in an average American household and took away everything that did not exist in 1809, there'd be almost nothing left. There'd be no Christmas trees. There'd be no Christmas lights. Those things are recent additions to the Christmas tradition.
Yeah, but don't you think most Americans would say, well, if they took all of that away, but I still had my family, and it was a time to gather my family together, they would still be pleased.
Of course. I mean, who doesn't love, on Christmas Eve, my mother made potato soup. And there was a certain Jell-O salad that had little pieces of carrot in it and little pieces of celery. And we discovered a few years ago that neither one of us liked it, but we had done it for like 50 years and we continued to do it because it's tradition.
Yeah, my folks, good Nordic stock, northern Minnesota, we had oyster stew, Swedish.
We had oyster stew, but you couldn't get fresh oysters in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, so... What about you now? Tell our listeners who've never heard of it what lutefisk is.
It's a cod fish.
It's a cod fish.
Which is great. Cod is great. And it is soaked in lye.
It's soaked long enough in lye that it becomes a gelatinous
mush.
Yeah. And it's a, I'm going to use this word, it's kind of forcing itself out of my mouth, a delicacy in the minds of some.
You know, I just read the other day that after 70 years, I think this is in Minneapolis, after 70 years of a church serving lutefisk dinners at Christmas time, this will be their last.
They finally saw the light because no rational being would eat lutefisk.
It's been so long that since I've tasted it, I can't even remember.
I have been here in our beloved North Dakota, I have been to many lefse parties where you go and you make these thin, very thin potato pancakes on a special oven. It's called lefse.
Great stuff.
It's Norse. And yep. People like, I went to one where they had like 7 or 8 of these rigs, mm-hmm. and it's like a production. It's like a factory. And if you made one mistake, they're wrapping you. It's like being in a Dickens novel. They're beating you up with the stick. I mean, people take lefse very seriously around here. That's another Christmas delight, and I like it better than lutefisk, I'll say that.
Speaking of Dickens, in your essay, I think you touch on Dickens, and it's time to go to that now. But lastly, it has been not a real festive Christmas.
This is our grumpiest Christmas show ever.
and
well done.
Yeah, you
did it. I blame you.
Yeah, it's probably all my fault. Well, hey, fire me, okay?
Yeah, that's you fire me, honey.
And Merry Christmas.
And there's the Christmas spirit here in the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn, which has a kind of nativity feel.
Next week, we're going to talk about the new year and upcoming things. And
I promise next year's Christmas program will be all positive.
But right now, it is time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Merry Christmas to you, David, and thank you, everybody. Happy holidays, everyone, from all of us at the Thomas Jefferson Hour. I'm going to be alone this Christmas for the first time in 20 years. So do feel free to send presents, cognac, figs, books, music, frankincense and myrrh, whatever you have. Don't cry for me, Argentina. I have Christmas plans. I drove up to the Charles Dickens Festival in Garrison, North Dakota last weekend. It's a town of 1,530 residents tucked into the north shore of giant Lake Sacagawea, the reservoir created by Garrison Dam back in the 1950s. This was the 25th annual Charles Dickens Festival. As you may know, The Iliad and Hamlet are my favorite books in the world. Walden is my favorite American book, though Twain's Roughing It and Huckleberry Finn are right up there, as is Melville's Moby Dick, but that for another time. If I could choose just one novel in all the world, it would probably be Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, or perhaps Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, which has perhaps the 100 greatest first pages in all of fiction, and perhaps the 100 greatest last pages, too. My poets are John Donne, John Keats, and John Milton, if you have to choose. But the English novelist I love most is Charles Dickens, which is what has taken me 4 times to Garrison, North Dakota, for the Dickens Festival. Almost every shop in town is called Ye Olde This or Ye Olde That, and though I have pointed out a few times that the phrase Ye Olde was long gone by the time Dickens was born in 1812, nobody likes a snothead. The Dickens Festival is part Norman Rockwell, part National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and I must say that you can spend an awful lot of time at the Dickens Festival without having any significant encounter with the life and work of Charles Dickens, but let's not get tripped up over technicalities. On the way home, brooding about Christmas alone at the great bend of the Missouri River in North Dakota, I decided to have a little Dickens Festival of my own this year. I ordered a Mr. Micawber plate from eBay, which ought to be here in plenty of time. I bought a Dickens Christmas ornament at the festival last week. To the untrained eye, it might be misrecognized as Karl Marx or Moses or Tom Selleck, but I will nevertheless hang it on the tiny tabletop Christmas tree that was my mother's favorite. I have a little book I got somewhere years ago called Christmas with Dickens, compiled by Cedric Dickens, the great-grandson of the author. I've marked the recipes I plan to use. Leek and potato soup for a starter, then sherried prawns, a small turkey with chestnut stuffing, brandy butter, and Christmas pudding with a coin, a shilling, inserted into it in the great British tradition. The person who finds the shilling gets to keep it and use it as a down payment for repairing that chipped tooth. And Dickens punch. Plenty of punch with rum and sherry and citrus and sugar and spice, the 5 necessary ingredients. And after supper, when I have settled into my favorite reading chair, with a roaring fire in my glass faux fireplace, with a quilt made by my grandmother Rhoda over my legs, an unprecedented extra glass of punch by my side, I will open one of 3 Dickens novels to read one of my all-time favorite passages, Mr. Micawber's Dinner Party from David Copperfield, or The Antics of Mr. Jingle from The Pickwick Papers, or the infamous porridge scene from Oliver Twist. "Please, sir, I want some more." Over the past year, I have purchased 2 new complete sets of Dickens, one on India paper, published in 1923, the other the Philadelphia Bibliophile edition of 1910. With great joy, and perhaps a dollop of melancholy, I will be reading Dickens on Christmas evening, stopping from time to time to pour myself a bit more punch. God bless us, everyone. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.